Yeah, I'm really happy to be with you tonight and with most of you for the whole weekend, the most of us together for the whole weekend. And hold on, I'm going to remove my face from taking all the screen space. That's going to be disturbing. I want to see you. Good, great. Yeah, so I'm both thinking we're spending the evening together as, LGBTQI2S plus folks, and that's lovely. And also I'm thinking that we're kind of starting a retreat together also, which is lovely. And to me always, it's strange because I think I've started retreats like this, like hundreds of them. And I always get kind of nervous, but I think in a pleasant way, but kind of vulnerable and shy and a little, maybe even a little confused, and unsure and all this. But I recognize now that it's in a way it's something beautiful. It means I'm alive and I'm a human being, and yeah, and I think it's also something very particular that we gather as queer folks, if that wording works for you, and yeah, I want us to be fully welcomed in this circle, let's call it like this, in this circle with all our identities, we might identify as non-binary or bisexual or intersex or two-spirit or lesbian or gay or what did I not name, queer, gender queer, and but also the other identities that we have related to language maybe, or the story of our people, the color of our skin, the culture or subculture or different culture that we belong to. This makes the encounter so much more beautiful that we have stories, and the stories that have not been told also that we carry with us, the struggles and the hopes and all this. Yeah. And to me, I'm really curious about queer dharma. I think it's there. It's around. It's in different places, in books and gatherings here and there of different groups of people. But I have a sense or hope maybe that it'll be more and more alive. And it will become its own, like, very, very vibrant thing in the same way that Tibetan Buddhism is very vibrant, or Zen Buddhism is very vibrant, or Theravada, like, I think there is the potential for queer dharma that can be so powerful for us. But I think also that it can be really an amazing resource, an amazing kind of lineage in its own way for people who don't belong to this community in the same way, where they could learn a lot from their own hearts and the aspects of liberation from something that would be called the queer dharma. And I'm looking a lot towards the future generations, the young people coming up who are maybe more clever than I am than I've been at this, at making the our queerness so essential, or mixing it so beautifully with the Dharma. And yeah, there's a lot of people doing this right now, and I think it's extremely exciting. I'm curious about this. At the beginning of my practice, I didn't think, like, I would go to a retreat, and I didn't know if my me as a gay man I was fully welcomed. I didn't know if I had to be silent about this, you know, in a spiritual milieu. Or, like, I didn't know. I would go to the Insight Meditation Society, and there was no clear sign that it was okay, you know, and I was so fortunate to run into, and maybe some of you have also, Arina Weissman and Larry Yang and other teachers, Shahara Godfrey, who is no longer alive, but was a really beautiful being, you know, queer person, teacher. And yeah, there's two things I want to say. Is I was not sure that it was welcomed in the spiritual environment when I came into Dharma. And also, I was not sure it was needed. Like, these two things, can they coexist? I'm not sure. I think they did in me. I was like, yeah, no, I'm fine. You know, it's one aspect of my life and this is another aspect. And several years within, you know, practicing Buddhism, I was one night I was in California with Larry Yang and Shahara, and they were going to do, I think, what was going to be the first Alphabet Sangha gathering in Oakland. And I said, they said, we're going there, we're going to do this first gathering. And I said, oh, I'll go with you. I mean, I could be doing something else, but I'll go to support you, Larry and Shahara, you know. And it was so powerful for me. First, when I got there, the first thing that I noticed was that it was very unlike what I had seen at Spirit Rock, where, you know, I would say 99% of the people were white, you know, in the retreat and the teaching body, in the, you know, the retreatants. And when we got there in Oakland, there was a, you know, like people from, you know, all different origins or ethnicity, or I don't know what is the right word, but like Americans, like you see Americans in the streets, you know, and they were all there, and all shapes and size, and, you know, all kind of people with all different kinds of abilities, you know, and it was so diverse in all kinds of ways. And I remember I was sitting there, and something in my body was like both choking with like emotion and also opening up. And that's when I discovered, oh, there's something about being in the community with the Dharma that is so precious to me, something so powerful in there. And you had Larry Yang, who was teaching, you know, and he kept saying, us queer people. And then 2 seconds later, a minute later, but he was saying, us same gender loving people. And then he would say us. And he was really very, very inclusive in the way he was talking, because he kept giving, you know, using all the word, the names we give ourselves, you know. And I could see him. He was really doing this very compassionately and wisely, and he kept like bringing people in, you know, so there was not invisibility and erasure and all this, and it was very, very powerful. And I think for the maybe a first time, I didn't know before, but for the first time, there was something. It was very bodily, like I felt I was fully in the space, like I had never been as in a certain way. And I remember, you know, a few years down the line, where I had the chance to assist Arina Weissman on LGBTQI retreats, and a few years back, a couple of years back, I think I was teaching an LGBTQ retreat in Amsterdam. And I remember at the closing circle, you know, people were expressing gratitude, as often is the case after a retreat, as many of you know, because there's so much things that are revealed and so much beauty, I think, difficulties of a retreat, but also the beauty of you know, the birth or cultivation of compassion, and maybe we're developing so much sensitivity during a retreat. And I remember there was a couple of people in the clothing circle who were, you know, literally crying, saying exactly this, describing the same experience I had had with Shahara Godfrey and Larry Yang. And they were saying, like, I didn't know, I've been practicing for 20 years, but there was something guarded that was not there this week in the retreat. There was something that I keep holding, you know, like to not, I don't know what, spill out, you know, my gayness or my queerness or my, you know, my binariness or my bi-ness or my whatever it is, you know. And it was very beautiful. Anyway, so these are things that come to my mind as we gather, and that I hope it's okay to share. Yeah, I feel excited about this queer dharma. I tell you, I don't know how you feel. I'd love to hear about it, but and you know, there's things that I've heard over the years from Manushka Fernando Poulet. You know, some of you know well, and have the chance to often teach with Anushka and others in readings. I don't know if you know about this book, which to me is such a reference. I don't know if you can see it. It's transcending. It's Trans Buddhist Voices. It came out, I think, a year ago, maybe a little bit more now. But I love this book so much. I just finished reading it, I think, for a third time. Transcending. And it's edited by Kevin Menders and Elizabeth Marston, who are in Vancouver. Maybe some of you know them. So it's partly Canadian, this thing. We're happy about this. And yeah, so what I love about the idea of a queer dharma, maybe that's the last thing I'll say, is I love how we take the teachings and give it a twist that really fits our experience, that expresses or you know, ways of freedom or wisdom or compassion through our stories, through our imagery. And even the narrative of the Buddha, I love to, you know, like how we watch a movie and we're like, oh, that person, you know, is, you know, they're going to transition soon. Or that, like, we recognize the story that is not told in the film, you know what, in the, but we're like, oh, this is the gay character in the story, or she's for sure, she's queer, you know, or whatever it is, you know. We do you have this experience of, like, you know? And I remember, because I trained as an actor, and I remember we were having this conversation with other actors. Sometimes we're like, oh, that character in Shakespeare, definitely queer. There's no doubt is in love with that other character, you know? And I love that we can do this. And it's important, I feel, to do this with the Buddha stories, you know? Hey, Ananda, best friend of the Buddha, there for 25 years, you know? I think when I read the sutras, everything to me indicates that this person, this is a gay man. And it's good. It's good for my soul. It's good for my, I can identify, I can get in that story, you know, and I understand him, and I understand why he says what he says, you know, and all this. And there's another character that from the very get-go, I connected with in a queer way, and maybe you know that character Rohitasa, and I love to tell the story of Rohitasa, because it feels like it's one of our stories, you know, like, oh, they might not know, they might not have noticed, the straight folks, you know, but we know what's going on, you know. And it's good, it brings joy. It's like suddenly we have visibility, even, you know, with what was happening 2,600 years ago, because of course we were in the story. Of course we were there, but of course we got erased, you know, like women got erased, you know, from all this patriarchy and all this. And so, So the beauty of the queer dharma. So I was thinking that we could maybe sit together for, I don't know, 20 minutes or so. Would that be a good thing to do together? And to me, to us, I mean, it's also like slowly entering into the retreat. And of course, we'll start the retreat with everybody tomorrow morning. But I'm entering the retreat. It's starting tonight for me, not tomorrow morning. And so, you know, not to, really important not to have any demands or expectation or like try to be efficient in some way in the practice. This is so not the path, as I'm beginning to understand, you know. It's so much more about, you know, allowing for things to settle, allowing for things to appear and be known in their own times. And I love the Buddhist cosmology for this. We have lifetimes. You know, we don't have to figure it all out this weekend or tonight. We have lifetimes to do this, you know. And so I invite you to find your posture. If you want, only if you want, close your eyes. If it feels right, if that's how you want to practice this evening. The beauty of being maybe home, like most of us are, I think, is that we can be more comfortable on our own cushion or in our own armchair or chair or bench. Or if we need to, we can lay down. We can even close the camera if we want. Or turn the screen away from us if it feels better. Whatever adjustment we want to do. And allow this trance body, this queer body, this bi-being, allow this being to fully relax here, if it wants to, or partly relax at least, if it wants to. Trying to resolve anything. So allowing maybe even for the aches that are there to be there if there are any. They could be physical discomfort. It could be emotional discomfort, pain. See if we can make space for that, if it's there. Maybe notice the environment. even with the eyes closed, maybe through hearing, the sense of space around you, or even through the light as it is at this point in the room where you are. Temperature of the room right now. There's a relative silence in the room. But also a shared silence as we sit together in presence. We see if we can stay here, not tune out, but stay here together, listening to each other. Being together. Just being together in silence, that's so radical. Discovering the familiar, discovering what it is like to be sitting. Discovering what it feels like to breathe. Be a sensitive being with senses, with the heart. in this discovering, there's a kind of not knowing. As if we had never been there before, never been here together in this way. It's completely new. We've never been alive now. Just seeing if it's possible to stay here, remain here when the mind wants to depart and thoughts and ideas, dreaming. Is it possible to stay here in this seat, in this body breathing, in this sensitive body, here in this Sangha, in this circle, this gathering? As we are here, aware of the environment, maybe through awareness of sounds or awareness of silence or temperature, as we are aware of being here, feeling the body, feeling the environment, feeling the body, we will notice the state of this being. Qualities that are there. Sometimes there's benevolence there, friendliness. Sometimes scatteredness. Sometimes confusion or obsession. Sometimes joy or tenderness. As we sit here together, we can notice without judgment, we can notice the quality of our heart or mind. Sometimes there is tiredness, sometimes wakefulness. Different qualities at different time. What are the qualities present now? You might be able to name them or just feel them directly. Oh, grumpy. Listening. Irritated. Calm. As you are here breathing, notice the state of your mind. Sometimes there is struggle in the heart or mind, strong emotions, of course. Sometimes there's absence of struggle. It can be good to recognize it if it's the case. And then just come back to the hands resting where they rest, to the play of sounds and silence. Staying here with our queer siblings. Notice how it is for you to be here, attentive at this point. Sometimes being attentive, aware, or in the listening mode is lovely. Sometimes it's uncomfortable or strange. Sometimes we feel it brings calm in the body, in the mind, in the heart. How is it for you to be attentive right now? And for the last minute, if you want, you could open the eyes, just if you want, And maybe you'll see the screen. I don't know if you see moi or if you see us. But it could be good just to take this last minute of practice with eyes open. How is it now to be together, to be embodied, to be us with us, like this? Maybe there's people you know here really well, good friends, or maybe you don't know anybody. But we're related by our humanness. We're related by our sensitivity. We all have senses. It's quite something to have senses, to be conscious being. We're related through this, and we're related through the alphabet that defines us or that we identify with. And we're related through the practice that we're doing together. This now, can you hear me good in this way? Because I thought I had more time before my partner was coming home. Now I don't know if you could hear him, but he's walking around. He's just coming back from babysitting his sister, his queer sister's baby. it's all in the family. Okay. So one thing that I've noticed that the practice has been, I think I want to say definitely helpful and maybe even more like powerful for me. This practice of just sitting, if we sit, we could be standing or lying down, of course, or we do it sometimes in walking, but this practice of sitting like this and switching value is one way that I experience it. When I give a lot of value to my thoughts in life, like what my dear teachers have taught me, I think that's what I've learned. One of the things I've learned from there is to not be so fascinated by every one of my thoughts, and follow my thoughts, but to switch value, start to give value to sensory experience, like closeness to, the experience of hearing. And it could be the local sounds of the street or inside the house, or it could be the silence, but to get attuned with the experience of hearing as it's happening, or the experience of breathing, feeling bodily sensations as they are happening, instead of always, following the train of thoughts and being, enamored by all the different productions of my mind, planning and speculating and rehashing and all this, like, so losing some of the fascination and tuning in to the system, the sensitive system. What I've gained that I didn't expect or foresee is somehow, I don't know if I'm going to be able to explain it well, but somehow
a lot of integrity, like by coming here instead of being in the ideas, by being here with this experience of here now, hearing and sensing the body breathing, and you know, just being aware of being in a posture, like sitting and staying there, like staying with, in a way, I want to say myself, you know. It helped me a lot discover who was this being, or to open the door to the intelligence of this being underneath what was prescribed by the society, what was the norms presented, or you know, what was underneath that, like a kind of ethics that is inner ethics, like what is true for this being apart from what is presented outside. And I think as a gay man, it's been extremely important. And for me, even more so as a HIV positive gay man, you know, when at least at some point in the history of that particular pandemic, you know, it was cursed, it was you were a monster, you know, there was a lot of stigma, and you know, you were ugly and you were going to die for your sins, you know, and all these messages were quite strong. And I'm so thankful to this practice of meditation and this Dharma, which kept inviting me to go and check what I was seeing inside. Was I seeing a monster? Was I seeing somebody horrible who deserved to die? Not at all. This is not what I was finding at all. So to me, this was truly liberating in you know, for as a LGBTQI2S gender non-conforming GNC person, you know. And I feel that there's a potential, there's a great potential. I don't know if it's, you know, it's, you relate to it in this way also. But for me, it was very clear that you know, compassion for this being was not the message I received in the dominant culture, you know. The message I received was I was to be hated or tolerated, maybe, you know. But deep love and compassion for this sensitive being, this was not, you know, maybe I got this in a relationship with my parents to a big extent, but in my relationship with society, I don't think so. Even as a white, you know, cis male, you know, just being gay I was receiving very disturbing messages. And so through the practice, to be able to go in there and discover, in a way, even underneath the identities, you know, like really like some kind of very naked thing, you know, of just breathing, just sensitivity is the best way I have to express it. Like, so I'm sitting here and at some point being gay disappears, you know, because there's just a breathing body and a sensitive body, sensitive to sound, to temperature, sensitive to ache, sensitive to gravity, sensitive to the ideas that come from inside, you know, that's a universal experience there, you know. And discovering the sensitivity to me was the opening of the door to compassion. I was hearing another member of our community a couple of weeks ago, who's Canadian also. We are always proud when there's Canadian. Canadian, very identified somehow. You might know Valerie Mason John. She lives in Vancouver. Anyway, she was talking about Dharma practice and she was saying, you know, yes, I'm absolutely queer woman, person of color, I'm absolutely black and a woman and a queer woman, or anyway, she was defining her identities like this, and she was saying it's so important, it's so central, it's so important that it's honored and celebrated and recognized, and it's, you know, it has so much to contribute and all this. And also, in practice, I learned that it doesn't exist. Also, it, you know, it's kind of made up, or I don't know how, what words she used, but it's so beautiful, this play of the fluidity of who we are, you know. And, you know, we hear this from wise trans people. They say, oh, I've discovered that gender, you know, is a fluid experience, or is, you know, I can be one day, or it's projected on me, this gender, and from the inside it's another one, you know. And and all the play around this. Anyway, I'm so grateful to the Dharma for this kind of healing, of learning to have love and compassion and tenderness for this being, instead of, like, you know, trying to fight against judgments and all this. And also in this kind of vein, if we can say this in English, in this line of thinking, or in this theme, I remember at the LGBTQ retreat at Spirit Rock, one day, Arina Weissman, do you know her? Some of you do, I think. No? She's a great teacher. Arina, you can sit with her. Or she's at Damadina now, in the south of California, and, you know, near Joshua Tree, I think. She travels around, and you can hear her on the Dharma Seed, and she has something about her, that's my describing her, I don't know if she would describe herself like this, but there's a kind of a grace about her, there's a, you know, this something, especially when she's on stage teaching, that there's something very, very graceful about her, and she has a South African accent that adds something to me when I hear her. And I remember one time she was sitting like this, and often her eyes are closed, and she'll, like, very slowly, like, offer, like, you know, golden wisdom, you know, like, just pieces like this. And one time she was sitting like this, and I was sitting next to her, maybe I was assisting or co-teaching, I can't remember, and my eyes were closed, and I was really tuning in, because I know it, to me, she's a kind of a channel of wisdom. And she said, I am honored to be queer. It was so powerful. It had never crossed my mind that I could be honored. Like, it was like I heard it. I mean, if I put words, but it was not words for me, apart hers, you know, it was a bodily experience. Like, my heart opened, and suddenly I too, you know, was honored to be queer. Like, it was almost like either a privilege or a blessing that life had given me, you know, not a curse, not something to be ashamed of or to curb. I don't know if that's the right word in English, like, to, you know, try to not have expand so much, you know. And she was saying, no, it's a blessing. It's an honor. And I could see, and that's the power of the Dharma. How is wisdom gained? There's two ways that wisdom is gained, they say in the teaching. It's either through mindfulness, to being attentive, to discover the truth for ourselves, or it's through the voice of another. And I remember I was sitting there, and when she said that, whoa, something healed in me. Like a big, 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 big queer healing, you know? Suddenly I went from being, you know, from internalized oppression, you know, of course I had worked on it, you know, and all this, but there was a hidden layer, unacknowledged layer, or a layer that I didn't want to deal with, you know, or trying to bypass or something, that suddenly, like, she turned it over and dissolved it, you know, with her few words. Suddenly I was honored, you know, it was a blessing, it was something beautiful, you know. and a power, you know, talk about something becoming a power, you know, like, you know, and then the teaching, it talks about this, how we can develop faculties that become powers, you know, like they're, you know, psychic powers, you know, that we can develop and practice. And suddenly my LGBTQI-ness was a power that some others didn't have. And I had on my side that I could use to understand the world, to participate, to contribute, you know. And this was through sitting retreats. And so, you know, parts of the healing are done, or at least have been done by, you know, the way I experienced it personally was by just tuning in this being here. And discovering, not quickly, but over a long time, like it took me a long time to kind of have this kind of insight or clarifying view suddenly that this was deserving of care. This was precious. This was ephemeral and contingent and fragile. An event full, I could say, like not so much a thing, but something that is passing through the universe, you know, like a gathering of energy that, you know, called Pascal in this case, you know, and it's deserving of only care, you know. And this insight is this kind of insight is also what's the word in English? It's inferential. So when discovering this about this system, it discovers this about all systems. Oh, if this one is precious, there was a misunderstanding, erroneous view, you know, that this was not lovable and this needed to be changed and improved and reorganized, and you know, and suddenly there was like, no, that was a wrong view. The wise view is that this is sensitive. Just because it's sensitive, it's touched by all kinds of things, you know, because it's constantly touched. It has senses, it's sensitive because it's constantly touched by things, it's deserving of care. It's not easy being sensitive. You know, ideas cross your mind, memories, future related ideas, you know, and then cold, and then warmth and heat, and then things that are, you know, smooth, but then they disappear. No, I want the smooth to stay. No, it's the harsh. You know, it's not easy being, do you agree with this, that it's not easy being a human being sensitive? So when we discover this inwardly from the inner experience, because in meditation that's a lot what we have access to, the experience of this being, we discover this, and then we discover, of course, we're intelligent, you know, we discover, oh my God, that's the same thing for everyone. Everyone is sensitive like this. Everyone carries around this system where they're touched by beauty and they're touched by discomfort and they're touched by hatred and they're touched by, you know, what is soothing and healing, deeply touched, deeply impacted. So of course, we are all, you know, worthy of care and respect, of consideration, of should I say a few words about Rohitasa? If you have heard it, I don't mind, because I've heard myself tell this story many times. I like it. It's like, you know, there's the little Red Riding Hood, you know, it's what you're like, oh yeah, what happened to her? What happened to them? You know, tell me again, you know. And Rohitasa, for me, it's a little bit like the same. It's like, oh, Rohitasa is back tonight, you know. at the campfireplace, around the campfireplace, you know, to remember Rohitasa. So Rohitasa is a human being that, no, actually they're described in the text as a, it's me who made them into a human being, but in the text they're described as a deva. Maybe that's a code word for queer. They're like a kind of a, you know, being, special being. So Rohitasa comes to the Buddha or hears about the fact that the Buddha is around, you know, around that area, you know, as if it happened to you, you know, somebody was to come, you know, and say, hey, you know, the Buddha will be online, you know, next Tuesday, you know. They're like, oh yeah, give me the Zoom room, you know. And so Rohitasa shows up, you know, and they have the chance to ask a question to the Buddha, which I think I love the story just for this, thinking, imagine if we had the chance to spend a few minutes, even like 10 minutes. It's like, oh, he's over there by the fire over there. You can go and ask him a question, you know, he'll be happy to answer. You're like, oh my God, hold on, the Buddha, what am I gonna ask? What's gonna be my question? What if I get to ask only one question, what is the question? That's very intriguing to me. Like, what would be my question if I had the chance to, but apart from the question, also to actually get closer to somebody who's known to be like monks, or maybe the wisest human being who ever lived, you know? I'd be really intrigued to see like, what does it feel like to be next to a person like this? What's their energy? You know, am I gonna get like really calm, or am I gonna get excited, or you know, will I crumble in tears, or, you know? Anyway, Rohitasa goes to the Buddha and asks this question that is very surprising. They ask, and they say, there's a whole kind of intro to the question, but first they ask the question directly. Is it possible by walking to reach the end of the world? I so would not have asked that question. Like, it's so certain that I would never have come up with that question to the Buddha. Is it possible by walking to reach the end of the world? And it makes me think of Joseph Goldstein, who has been my dear teacher for many years, you know, when he trained us to teach Anushka and many people, of course, but you know, in my cohort, there was a bunch of us, gay, lesbian, queer, etc. Anushka, Larry Yang, and oh God, her name just escaped me. Anyway, it'll come back. Anyway, Joseph would say to us, when people ask a question and you don't understand what they ask, just answer something about the Dharma. Just pick it up, turn it around, and if there's something you wanted to say anyway, like put it in there, you know, like turn the question around. So I don't know if that's what happens to the Buddha, but Rohitasa says, is it possible by walking to reach the end of the world? And the Buddha says, no, Rohitasa, it's not possible by walking to reach the end of the world. And Rohitasa starts to say, yeah, well, so funny you should say that, because I tried. And Rohitasa has a lot of energy, a lot of like brightness. Makes me think of, is it Puck in Shakespeare's, like it's a spirit, like really like playful and confident, has a lot of confidence. And You know, as the first time I read that story and I met Rohit Asad, I'm sure they're non-binary. Like, there's no doubt to me when I read it, I can see, you know, that they're non-binary. Anyway, so they said, I tried. I walked and walked and ran, and I never stopped for a long, long time. Actually, I did stop. I stopped to rest a little bit, honestly, but just a little bit. It's important to eat, to pee, and defecate. They're really, really, really clean with the Buddha. You know, no, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to tell you the whole truth. And I tried to reach the end of the world, and it didn't work. So I'm amazed that you know that it's not possible. And in the stories, it says that it's a deva. So it means when they make a step, they do a step, it can be over a whole sea, you know, or a whole ocean, you know. And they never read, they probably kept going around. Anyway, they never succeeded. And so they say, I'm really amazed that you know that, you know, that it's not possible. And the Buddha says, no, Rohitasa, it's not possible by walking to reach the end of the world. And that's like, a little golden bit here. The Buddha said, it's not possible by walking to reach the end of the world. But I say also, Rohitasa, that to reach the end of suffering, you have to reach the end of the world. And Rohitasa, the world, the beginning of the world, the end of the world, is in here, in this fathom-long body, in here, in this fathom-long body. I think somebody told me it's like when you swim, fathom is long, like two arms or something like this. Like, well, long like a human being. So, yeah, the end, the beginning of the world, the end of the world, the way to the end of the world is in here, in this body, with its perceptions, with its mind and perception, something like this. And what I love in that is that that's what I hear is the Buddha saying, hey, stop running, sit there. And watch your mind and be aware of like hearing and of the body breathing, you know, and you'll discover the whole of the construction of the world. You'll discover how, you know, transphobia or homophobia, internalized transphobia or homophobia found their way into your mind. You'll discover this. Sit there and you have to see the beginning of the world and the end of the world and the way to the end of the world in here. And I love that. It's so, to me, you know, and that's, you know, hearing this story is what kept me signing up for retreats. You know, let's go back in there for a weekend. Yes. For a week. Yes. For 3 weeks, 6 weeks, 3 months. Yes. Let's go back in there. I'm going to, like, I hear the instructions of the Buddha to Rohitasa, I hear them personally, as if they were given to me. So you're telling me, because I didn't have the chance to be there 2,600 years ago, but some of the stuff have been recorded, and especially that little bit of queer dharma. So I take these instructions really personally. And the instructions is to sit there and notice how the world is constructed. And to me, the Dharma is exactly this, or the practice is exactly this. I sit there and I'm not supposed to figure anything out. I'm just invited to notice what's here, breathing, hearing or silence. And then the beginning of the world appears, you know. Suddenly there's a sense of an I that is unworthy. I get to see it arise, the beginning of a certain world view. Do you see what it means by the world? Like a kind of a way to see things. So the end of the world is not the collapsing of the planet. the beginning and the end of the world is how the world is fabricated in the mind, how we view it, how we construct and interpret or perceive it. How we perceive it is a lot of made up things, huh? Learned from family, from culture, from, you know, biases against others, biases against ourselves, our community, etc. And by sitting, we can clear up a lot of the, you know, see the end of the world. And the Buddha says it's not possible without reaching the end of the world to find freedom or happiness or end suffering. Oh la la. And I think we have the chance to do this for a whole weekend, you know, slow down a bit and tune in and not put expectations, because it comes with views, you know, like I should be getting this, so I'm looking for this and I'm not getting this. It's so rigid, this kind of mind. But we make ourselves available and we just follow the instructions with our, which are quite simple, not easy, but simple. Can we stay here? Can we stay here in this body as it's breathing, as it's hearing? And then we'll see all kinds of things arise. You know, maybe self-loathing, maybe self-aggrandizement. I don't know which is your drug of choice, you know? Maybe the desire to be somewhere else, to experience something else. You know, you'll see a world being created, you know? And then if we stay around, we'll see it collapse also. Huh? Like, oh, if I was post-pandemic, you know, when it's going to be over, you know, this world would appear. And in the course of a sitting, if we keep returning, at least we'll notice, oh, it collapsed, you know, the world of after the pandemic appeared in my mind and collapsed, you know, and the view of self, the different ways we hold self, you know, the kind of self we created, that is, you know, might be many of us, at least, I think, I've created a sense of a self that is defective. We have a self we believe in or perceive or sense, you know, and it's a defective one. It's unworthy, or I don't know if that's the case for you, but for me, it's kind of hidden there. You know, I look like I'm confident and this and that, but hiding there in the swamp of the psyche, you know, there's something always ready to come out and say, you're a piece of shit. You know, and I have to see this world arise and collapse, you know, to notice it's not true, it's not permanent, it's not solid, it's more of a mirage, like, you know, boogeyman. Is that, I don't know where I took this, but